As Justin plays bombs over Baghdad, we're talking about kickers who hit bombs. That was a professional level sequitur.
I try.
Harrison Larner is on the phone line with us. We talked about field goal kicking, onside kicking. People have been trying to phase it out of the game. They say it's not effective anymore without the run-up. Tell that to Greg the Leg Zuerlein. One of the most incredible kicks I've ever seen. So, Harrison, really when we're talking about this, just I can't really do anything to explain it from an analytical standpoint. I don't have the knowledge base. You tell me what you saw.
So, obviously, the Cowboys are in the midst of this huge comeback. I turn on the game, and Greg Zuerlein, for an onside kick, decides he's just going to put the ball on the ground, which, to be honest, I wasn't even sure it was legal. I had never seen someone do it. Generally, what you do on an onside kick is there's a notch at the front of your kickoff tee where you place the point facing towards you and then the other point on the ground facing towards your aim target mm-hmm. and just kind of toe it. Well, we can get that into that later with Young Wei Koo. What he does is he just puts the ball on the ground, landscape style, like, you know, side to side. So what he does is he uses the inside of his foot, sort of the instep. He hits the right side of the ball, creating a counterclockwise spin to the left, and that ball zips towards the sideline with that spin. Now, what the Falcons players are trying to do, that front line, is not recover the ball.
Right.
Their assignment is to block the Cowboys' front line so the hands team behind them can recover the ball.
Sure.
And we'll get into that in just a second. So what they see, if you look at it from their perspective, is a ball spinning really, really fast, but also on a direct line right to the sideline. In the 5 out of 10 minimum yards it needs to travel before a recovery is possible, the ball travels 75% of the way to out of bounds. And Dan Quinn confirmed in a press conference today that their front line of the Falcons thought the ball was going out of bounds. And if you look at the replay, it's fairly obvious that it appears that's the trajectory it's going to go. However, you know, we all know how friction works. This ball is on the ground, and it begins to slow down. And that's where the spin of the ball really, really kind of takes into effect and makes the ball go from a straight line trajectory right towards the sideline, and it begins to curve and eke up to that 10-yard marker. Now, the Falcons players, in revisionist history, we know that ball is going to go 10 yards.
Mm-hmm.
However, those Falcons players who think that that's not our assignment. We're trying to block. So why would they jump on the ball immediately?
Right.
The only reason that they'd want to jump on the ball is if it goes 10 yards. And there's no reason to risk it if they don't think it's going to go 10 yards because this ball's spinning out of control. If you jump on it, pops underneath, easily recover.
Yep.
You know, people go LOL Falcons either way.
That's where I'm at. I'm right there with you, and not to cut you off. Because I'm watching that, and I'm like, okay, if the Falcons player jumps on it, what's the odds that he just gets absolutely decked, knocked off the ball, and then he's the idiot who touched it before it went 10 yards? I thought it was just an incredible onside kick.
I saw it the same way. I wanted to go out to a field and try to see if it's possible to do, you know, for like a normal human being. It was absolutely incredible. Do I think that he meant to do it in exactly that way? No, I really don't think he meant. I think what he was trying to do is just a slow roller enough to where it would get to and kind of do a low bounce type deal to where his players could try to recover it at 10 yards. And I think he put a little bit, you know, hit it a little bit to the left versus what he wanted to. I mean, obviously it's a difficult kick. And it just curved in such a perfect way. So I really don't blame. I mean, obviously, you know, they made a mistake. They could have waited and, you know, hopped on the ball. But I credit that much more to the success of Zuerlein and to the Cowboys recovering team who had their heads up on the play, jumped on the ball, credit to them, than I do as such a bad player for the Falcons.
So this morning, and shout out to the Good Morning Football crew for enlightening me to this fact, apparently it's called the watermelon strategy to kick it like that off the ground and try and give it that side spin. I was going to ask you how common that is, but it sounds like this is the first time you've heard of it.
I've never seen someone do this at the NFL level. I've never seen someone do this at the college level. I've never seen someone do this at the high school level. It doesn't mean it hasn't happened. I saw referred to as the helicopter kick. The watermelon kick kind of sounds even more accurate. What I think probably is that Zuerlein has a bag of onside kicks. You know, he probably has three or four.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cowboys coaches saw a weakness that the Atlanta front line, who is probably very used to practicing against Young Wei Koo in practice,
right,
who generally does kicks that are going to be trying to, you know, go to the hands team, to where they're so used to practicing that that they wouldn't be expected to recover the ball themselves. That's effective scheming by the Cowboys coaches as well, and effective execution.
That's what's so incredible to me, because you're watching this, and it's obviously, for most of the people watching, unlike anything you've ever seen on a football field. It looked like I was watching curling for a second. Like, I was expecting somebody to pull out a broom and start shuffling to try and get that ball across that 10-yard mark. It just kind of happened. I don't know how you really explain something like that, but now this is a thing that maybe saves the Cowboys season. That seems premature 2 weeks in, but we know the numbers about 0-2 teams, obviously influenced by the fact that there's going to be three wild cards this year, but 0-2 teams don't make the playoffs, and that is the difference between one of these teams going 1-1 and the other one going 0-2. When you're a kicker coming up to take that kind of kick, is there more pressure in that situation than, say, trying to hit a game-winning field goal, or no?
I mean, obviously, it depends from kicker to kicker. Once you get to the NFL level, generally, those are the guys who are able to manage pressure better than other people, because there's, you know, hundreds of people out there who can hit 50, 60-yard field goals. However, I would argue that he probably felt more pressure just because he's not used to doing that in a game. And maybe at some point in his life, at high school or college, he maybe tried one of those, but I doubt he's tried it at the NFL level. So he was probably quite nervous. A kick like that, where you're pretty much putting yourself at the mercy of the bounce of a football, which is, you know, obviously extremely unpredictable, to realize the path of, which, you know, shown by the Falcons. So I would argue that he probably felt a lot of pressure in that situation, even compared to what Butker felt, because, you know, if you watch Butker, I mean, he's angry, you know, he's showing emotion, all this stuff. That's something you do when you're comfortable. When you're afraid, you aren't yelling and getting excited and all that kind of thing. That's something you do when you're comfortable. He was just, you know, Zuerlein looked bewildered after he made that kick. He was probably just as surprised as the Falcons recovery team was.
Huh. So you mentioned Young Wei Koo earlier when we were talking about onside kicks, which is, that's the ironic part, because the Falcons have the best onside kicker, at least by the numbers, in the NFL, in their South Korean place kicker, Young Wei Koo, who has made a name for himself now on being an elite onside kick master. Let's talk about him. How much of a weapon is it to have a guy that you actually can get an onside kick and recover it around 50% of the time, as his numbers indicate throughout his career?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love the irony that the Falcons got Young Wei Koo themselves. And part of the reason we talked about it is that they're so used to practicing against Young Wei Koo is that he has a certain style, and it was different than what they were used to. I would argue that it's an advantage. However, some people seem to think that it's crazy, huge advantage that makes Young Wei Koo extremely valuable. I would argue his field goal kicking is more valuable. So here's sort of what I've looked at. And this is an advanced football analytics piece from now ESPN writer Brian Burke. And obviously this is slightly outdated. However, the expected points he calculated for a normal kickoff is -0.7, because you're giving the ball to the other team, you know, around the 20, 25-yard line. The expected points of an onside recovery is just 1.2 points. And an onside failure is -2.1 points, because the other team is going to have the ball in favorable field position. So it's just a few points. It's basically the difference between a made field goal and a missed field goal. And he's been accurate on field goals, which I'd argue is even more important. However, there is some kind of like mental boost I think the Falcons perhaps could feel, knowing that like they have a chance no matter what. Especially against the Seahawks. I mean, even though it didn't work out, there is some advantage to that. And he's had success going 5-for-5 on onside kicks is mind boggling, but I don't know if that trend's going to keep up.
I'm going to ask this, and I think I already know you're lean based on what you just said, and the math is correct. You are right. I would say that getting an onside kick recovery is the equivalent to getting a turnover on defense. And if you've got a defense that can get turnovers, the onside kick factor becomes less valuable. It's just another way of getting a takeaway, an extra possession, when you break it down by the numbers. But I do want to know, so if there were a kicker down the road in the future that could assure that he will recover 75% of his onside kicks, is that guy worth a first-round draft pick? Is he the second most valuable player on your football team aside from your quarterback?
So there's two sort of caveats that I will make with that. The first being is that even with Younghoe Koo's success, teams are going to start scheming against him. I recently talked with my old kicking coach, who's an NFL kicker, Todd Peterson, and he said that if he just kept trying onside kicks over and over again, his success rate would probably fall below 10%, just because teams are going to be a lot more effective with scheming against it, and they're going to practice going against these kicks in practice, which normally they wouldn't want to do because it's seen as a waste of time, especially with such little practice time this offseason. But to go back to your question, in the same article by Brian Burke, if you have an onside kicker that can do more than 42.4% and recover their own onside kicks, then you're winning. And then that's a positive contribution to your team. If there was a guy who could get 70%, I mean, if you're averaging, I'm trying to think, maybe you'd average 5 kickoffs a game. I don't really know. I can't think of the math off the top of my head. That's going to be worth 6 or 7 points, potentially, by expected points added. So that would be extremely valuable. I would consider, in order to say like where I would draft them, where are they in terms of like field goal accuracy and kickoffs?
Let's just say they're one of the top 10 kickers in the league in that regard.
If they were a top 10 kicker in the league in terms of field goal percentage and kickoffs and could do 75% onside kicks, you would draft the number one overall. And I wouldn't really do that with much hesitancy.
Get Cristiano Ronaldo on the phone. I've got an idea for him after he retires. Of course, that's Harrison Larner, and I'm not just dumbing it down. I know that just because Ronaldo's good at soccer doesn't mean he'd be a good kicker.
You were excellent. In a few years, I bet he could put it up, man.
People are talking. Harrison Larner, thank you, my friend. Again, just tell the people where they can find you and the cool stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, so all that Younghoe Koo information and any other onside kick, making another video this week, is going to be at 8 in the Box Productions. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram. We just are starting just a few minutes ago a huge Instagram giveaway. Once again, that is 8 in the Box Productions. Thanks so much for having me on, Peyton. It's been a blast.
Anytime. We may have to check in with you throughout the year to figure out what's going on in the kicker sphere. That was Harrison Larner. We're going to get to a break. It's Run It Up, WKGN, Fox Sports, Knoxville. Run It Up. It's Monday.
Which means we had college football this weekend.
That it does. It's game week for Tennessee. We're going to dive into more SEC-related stuff throughout the week, hopefully with some good guests lined up to talk about the Vols, everything going on in the best conference in America. I say that with my full chest. SEC, it just means more. But the SEC didn't play this weekend.
Soon.
You know who did? The Raging Cajuns.
Some teams played.
The Raging Cajuns played football this weekend, and they are 2-0, and it was a lot scarier for them than a lot of people thought it would be.
Electric. Overtime game at Turner Field. We have overtime football at Turner Field this weekend.
You are giddy, downright giddy, talking about this game, which I watched. Louisiana struggled. It did not look good. They trailed 14-0 to start it, trailing the whole way, found a way to get it into overtime. And Elijah Mitchell took over down the stretch, and Louisiana is 2-0.
They are. So how bad is Iowa State now?
Bad.
Yeah.
Again, the Big 12 struggles continue. They went 0-3 against the Sun Belt 2 weeks ago. That is not good from a Power 5. An important thing to note here, and I said this whenever we started talking about college football this year, it's just going to come down a lot of times to who's been able to practice, who's been able to avoid COVID. That's going to determine games. It is. And when you look at Iowa State, when you look at what happened in the Big 12, you have to also note that all these schools that won had spring ball and had full contact practice, whereas it was limited in the Big 12. That's going to influence things, and we're seeing it now as a team that beat a ranked Iowa State team on the road struggles with another Sun Belt team. Of course, Tennessee fans, I'm going to rub salt in the wound a little bit here, know exactly how competent Georgia State can be. Anyway, Grant Wells and the boys taking down Appalachian State. Appalachian State had only lost to Georgia Southern and Penn State in overtime. Those were the only teams that have beaten them over the last 2 years. They've lost to Georgia Southern twice, and they've lost to Penn State, a top 10 Penn State team in Happy Valley, in OT. They went up to Huntington, West Virginia. They did not have a fun time. We are Marshall gentlemen.
Grant Wells didn't even play that well. They still won.
What else can you say? I didn't watch a lick of that game.
Me neither.
But Marshall won, and it's the only pick I got right this week.
Speaking of the Sun Belt, their best team preseason, App State, a traditional powerhouse, if you can use that word in that conference, just got beat. So that's something. By a CUSA team.
The Sun Belt is the fifth Power 5 that we've already always needed because the Pac-12 may or may not play.
Not the AAC.
No, not the AAC.
Speaking of the AAC, they got a big win. Top 15 UCF.
Yes, they did.
Whipping up on Georgia Tech.
Sims was not a dog in this game. I was incorrect. Not good.
Yeah. It happens.
The actual game that mattered this week, no disrespect. Georgia Tech, or rather Miami, don't know where I was going there. Miami took on Louisville in a game that I thought would be Scott Satterfield's coming out party. I thought now, his name is Malik Cunningham now. It was Mikhail Cunningham. Back to Malik. Tutu Atwell, Javian Hawkins, this Louisville team was going to announce themselves nationally in a nationally televised game against another ranked opponent. It was the opposite. I called Manny Diaz a bad coach on this program.
As did I.
I'm not going to jump to conclusions after 1 week, one way or the other, but that was impressive. That was damn impressive, what they did with De'Eric King. Those two tight ends, Brevin Jordan running all over the place, that defense playing with attitude, Ed Reed's on the sideline coaching the boys up. They've got turnover rings. They got turnover chains. They have swag. And Miami was sapped of that last year. They were impressive, very impressive in this game. And you have to ask, we thought for sure Florida was the best team in the state. It might be UCF. It very well might be Miami.
Miami, UCF, that'd be a good game.
Just all the Florida teams should play.
That'd also be entertaining. You know what the funny part about that is? Is that Florida State probably wouldn't even make the top three or four.
Right now, I might take FAU. That's where we're at. Shedeur Sanders will go there, son of Deion Sanders. Also, big shout-out to Deion Sanders before we wrap up this college football talk. Talk a little NBA playoffs with Carson Breber before we get you out of here. Deion Sanders taking his talents to Jackson State University to be with Snacks and the boys.
Coach Prime.
I'm excited about this because ask Catholic what they think about Deion Sanders and his coaching ability.
Primetime getting a head coaching, college head coaching gig, D1 college head coaching gig, straight off of being the OC for his son's high school team.
I love that he's going to an HBCU, though. And
that's cool.
That's the coolest part of this is we've talked about what is it going to take for these HBCU schools to really start getting these top-end recruits. And this is it. Deion Sanders walks into your living room and you're a defensive back, you got a shot. I don't care if you're coaching at the D3 level. And if what Mikey Williams is talking about, potentially going to play for an HBCU on the basketball side of things, Maker already committed to Howard. If things can start to percolate at Jackson State with Deion Sanders. That'll incentivize the other HBCU schools to say, hey, this can work for us too, and really start to invest in these football programs.
Maybe in 5 years we're talking about Coach Prime going to the Seminoles and bringing the Seminoles back here after he gets some head coaching experience under that belt.
I'm just saying, I actually thought that they should hire him instead of Mike Norvell at the time. Would have been risky, but you got a chance with any recruit in the country if you've got Florida State money and then you've got Deion Sanders prime time in your living room. That's
he's a Barstool employee coaching for a – he's your head coach. He's coming in your living room to recruit you.
I don't know if he's still – that's an interesting question. Is he still with Barstool?
That would be wild. That would be wild. You want to talk about Taylor Lewan and Will Compton having a podcast while they're NFL players? Deion Sanders having a Barstool podcast while he is an NCAA football head coach.
The Barstool Deion Sanders coaching show, coaches show, just talking about the week's game, but it's on Barstool.
There's a platform.
Trademark. Carson Brebber is up next. This is Run It Up, WKGN, Fox Sports Knoxville. Back half of our number two. We've talked about onside kicks. We've talked about Jackson State football. Let's get back to a little bit of normalcy. Carson Brebber is with us. We're talking NBA playoffs on a day in which we don't have a basketball game, only the second day like this in about 2 months. Yes.
Sorry, I don't have any kicker material today. I feel a little bit unprepared.
It's fine. You know, not everybody can be Harrison Larner. I'm not asking you to. You're a role player. You know your role.
And I embrace it.
So, today renders a unique opportunity, right? Because we, and not that, and I'm speaking for you here, I don't think either of us minds talking about and analyzing the actual product on the floor, right? But because there's not a game to break down necessarily, we get an opportunity here to talk about some of the bigger stuff at play in the bubble. The legacy stuff, the impact stuff. Anthony Davis had the biggest moment of his career last night. And that's a fact. That's not a statement. That's not a pontification. That is a factual doctrine that I'm putting onto the airwaves. So, to you, what was that shot that he hit at the buzzer last night to give the Lakers that win in Game 2, given that decisive 2-0 lead? What does that represent as a plot point in the story arc of his career to this point and moving forward?
Well, to this point, it's everything, because we've obviously seen the incredible individual accomplishments from him. He had that unbelievable sweep of Portland when they were the lower seed, when he was utterly dominant, and he's never failed to put up numbers individually in the playoffs, not saying that they're empty numbers, he just didn't have the talent and the infrastructure around him to advance any further than the first or one time the second round. Now we're seeing that when he's paired with a dynamic force, he is every bit the kind of guy who can carry you in individual games and who can be a dominant figure for an entire postseason on a championship team. And I don't think if there was ever doubt about that, but the guy's averaging 29, 11, and 4 on 57% from the field and 40% from three. And last night was just another incredible demonstration of the skill that this guy has. It's just the evolution of the big man, and it's amazing to watch a guy who at 6'10 has this unbelievable athleticism, comes into the league as a raw, incredible defensive specimen who can dunk it on your head. And now, sometimes I get a little bit frustrated with him because he does a little bit too much of the I'm a guard thing handling from up top. But at some point, you just need to lean back and appreciate when a guy can make a difficult contested three to win the game, and he's also the greatest lob threat of all time and a brilliant post scorer, or when he can hit these post fades again and again and again and take people off the dribble. The guy's just really that special. And it's great to see he's the kind of guy who deserves to be in a winning situation. And listen, I don't know how the following seasons go because we don't know how LeBron's going to age, although up to this point he has aged like a very fine wine. But AD is going to be a fixture in this league as a true superstar on contending teams if things go right around him.
And that was the biggest question about the Lakers. And early on in the bubble experiment, you saw Anthony Davis, and I think it's fair to say that a lot of people, including myself, had reservations about whether he could be this. And what I'm talking about is whether or not he could be the kind of player that on this biggest of stages, because they were going to get there merely by having LeBron in the playoffs, could he dominate? Could he take over? Could he take that pressure off LeBron James to be the best player on the Lakers on any given night, be the best player on the floor? The emphatic answer so far this postseason has been absolutely yes.
Yeah, and it will continue to be. He's been the best player in each of the first two games. He has been unbelievable defensively. It's been fascinating how much they've played Dwight and JaVale in this series, and I think that that was something that neither of us expected, and we talked about how we thought it would be to their disadvantage. I'm still not sure that I love the decision, but AD's ability to make quick rotations to not only affect shots with his length, but to get there so quickly and wave those long arms at people to the point where they don't even attempt the shot. The guy's averaging 29-11-4, and he also probably should have been the defensive player of the year. So I don't know if there ever was any merit behind questioning his impact in these big spots, but this is the difference maker for the Lakers. This is what I have hammered home again and again on this show and throughout this entire season, once I realized that there was a fundamental flaw with the Clippers, that being that Paul George was not a second star that you could rely on. Anthony Davis is, and that's the difference. There are degrees of unstoppability. You can be unstoppable when both guys are going, like a team like the Nuggets are, when Murray and Jokic are both going, and that's wonderful. But when your two best stars are physically overpowering, also tremendously skilled, who can dominate on both ends, and who can take every single game over, have so many things that they can turn to if the shot's not falling. AD can shoot 20 free throws in a game if he needs to, and eat up 15 boards and be the best defensive player on the floor. That's just a championship formula. And when the role guys around them step up, that's nice. But this is special from AD, and he deserves this. I think that sometimes people get ahead of themselves and they say things like I genuinely hear people from this generation say he's the greatest power forward of all time, which I marvel at. But as far as talent, he is in that discussion, absolutely. And when the winning accompanies that, like it is likely to when LeBron James is also on your team, it's special. And I'm not going to predict multiple championships from this team because there are so many unknown variables. But if they trot this roster out next year with these two still at the peak of their powers, then it's tough to bet against them. And AD is a huge part of that.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about what his ceiling as a player is, right? Because he is at the age of 27 now where he is truly entering his prime. He's no longer this mercurial young talent that you want to see where he goes. We know who Anthony Davis is now. So as LeBron ages and he becomes a dominant force on an assumed title contender in Los Angeles, is there a ceiling, a universe? And this is fair and probably an overreaction to what he's doing right now. Unfair, I should say. Can Anthony Davis at some point in his career be the best player in the world, flat out?
I don't know. It's incredibly difficult to be that as a big man in the modern NBA just because time and time again it is the perimeter creators who take over. Although I loved it in last night's game, it wasn't. It was two big men showing off their incredible skills going at each other in a scoring duel. I don't know if AD can get there. But when I look at the guys who I have above him, there are only three in my opinion. I only have LeBron, KD, and Kawhi above Anthony Davis. LeBron probably isn't going to be at the peak of his powers for that much longer. Lord knows what KD is going to look like when he comes back. And so then you're looking at him one-on-one versus Kawhi for the best player in the world title, at least in my eyes. Can he take that? I think so. It's not the kind of thing I'm going to bet on. And in fact, right now, I'm still not positive that he could be the best player on a championship team just because I think that there need to be a lot of pieces around him, and he was their closer last night, but he can't really be your closer consistently. But the guy's incredible, and it is how special he is defensively that takes him up to that level where I can see him there. I love Anthony Davis. He's certainly not there right now, and again, I'm not sure if he can be the best player on a championship team, which is crazy because I think he's a top four player in basketball, and based off of this season, I would say he's a top three guy in basketball if I'm trying to go out there and win a title, but there is obviously a mold that is more favorable because it's easier for a perimeter player to take over a game consistently. But he has the talent. He's continued to develop, and he's shooting really well right now, 40% from three in these playoffs, essentially. But he's been a 33-34% shooter over the last few seasons, and we continue to see him improve that handle, improve that shooting off the dribble. If he ever gets to the point where he can be 37% from deep, that's an insane ceiling where you're talking about he very well could be the best player on the planet. And I don't think that's out of the question because his shooting touch seems to get better and better every single time I see him out there. It's been unbelievable in this past series and a half. He decimated the Rockets by hitting consistently contested jump shots.
Sure.
That was his formula. And last night it was, in some ways, more of the same. So if he continues to unlock that ceiling as a jump shooter, then good God, it's unthinkable what he could be. And if LeBron stays close to this level, again, it's one of the great duels of all time.
And they're also going to be able to reassemble some things around those two as they age, as certain contracts like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Danny Green, go out of circulation. They're going to be able to readjust and refit. And it'll be interesting to track where this team goes. I'm just going to put this out there. In a lot of ways, Anthony Davis does almost everything that Giannis does, aside from the athletic ability in the open floor, running the floor, handling the ball in that regard. But he's also a much more polished and better shooter.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think those two compare very quickly here before we move on?
I have been an AD over Giannis guy, and you can check the receipts. I made a list back in April. I had AD as the fourth guy I would take to win the title, and Giannis is the fifth. And I think that the fundamental reason is that skill. AD can be your closer if you need him to. Is it ideal? No, but it worked last night, and it won them a game when no one else was stepping up, and that includes LeBron James. AD was the only person to score for them in the last 5 minutes. Giannis cannot do that. He does not have that ability to hit a contested three to win you a game. He does not have the ability to hit six post fades for you if he needs to. That's the distinction. And I also think that AD is a better defensive player because Giannis's job is just easier. He's a rover. It's not as impactful as a guy who intimidates people from coming inside, which is what AD consistently does, and he's also pretty quick on his feet for big man standards. So I think AD's a better player, and he'll never have the regular season accolades because he's not even going to be the best player on a contender, at least through his age 27 season, which Giannis was at his age 24 season. But that doesn't mean that he's not actually the better player because accolades don't always capture someone's true value and their impact when it comes to winning time in the playoffs, where I think AD is on another level.
That's totally fair. I think everything you just said there is spot on. So let's move to the Eastern Conference now. We're talking about these young cores of players. In the Lakers' sense, they have the veteran guys. They've got LeBron James, who's 35, and then they've got Anthony Davis, who's 27. Two players who are firmly in the prime of their career. You look across the rest of the league, the other three teams remaining, and aside from Jimmy Butler and maybe Kemba Walker, the best players on these teams are all guys under 25. So I want to look at the Celtics for a second and the historical precedent around this team. Do you right now think that Tatum can be the best player on a team to make the finals, right? And how do you think he would stack up against other 25-year-old players that have been the best player on conference championship-winning teams, like the 2012 Thunder, like the 2007 Cavs with LeBron James?
Well, I do think that he can be the best player on a team that makes the finals. But I think that that's because this is an incredibly talented all-around Celtics team that's brilliant. It's brilliantly coached. It has an incredible defensive identity and also has a bunch of shot makers. He is not, to me, comparable to young LeBron or young KD. KD averaged 29 a game in those playoffs and was pretty consistently carrying them to
He's a top five player.
These big spots.
He was a top five player
in basketball.
Yeah.
LeBron, obviously, we're all familiar with what he was doing. He was carrying a bum squad to that level. So I think that there's really not much of a comparison there, but the question is he good enough to do it with all of the pieces around him? And I say, yes, I do think that he's on that level. What's interesting, though, is when I compare him to him and along with Jaylen Brown to the guys out west and Jokic and Murray, I think that Tatum and Brown have throughout their careers been the more often discussed as this exciting young tandem, the kind of guys who can build a dynasty. Who's stepping up and getting their team 25 every single time when they need it, though? And who is their crunch time offense every single time effectively? And so I think that does speak volumes, and it's more of a Jaylen thing than Tatum. Tatum does have the skill set that is undeniable, and it's what we were talking about with AD being the best player in the world versus those perimeter wing guys. Tatum is in the mold of the kind of guy who can be the best player in the world. I don't think he's going to get there. I do think he will be pretty darn close someday. And I do think that down the road he will be capable of being the best player on a championship team. And he's been really good in these playoffs for the most part. But there have been times in the biggest moment where he just doesn't look quite ready. And I think that when you compare that to LeBron, when you compare that to KD, I don't really feel that that was the case. People talk about how those Thunder teams weren't ready to win a title. I think they just came up against a better team in the Heat. And this Miami Heat team is not comparable to the LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, et cetera team that handled the Thunder. So if the Celtics do go down to a Heat team that they really should beat comfortably on paper, then I think that tells you not necessarily that Tatum and Brown are some sort of playoff underperformers, but that they're not ready. And that's understandable at 22 years old. We can't expect everyone to be in that all-time pantheon-level big-time performer. But it's interesting because their window is now in some ways. It's going to extend for a long time because most of the stars on this team are young. But when the top two seeds in the conference are knocked out, when you have to beat a team whose best player is not a top 10 guy in basketball, that's a real window. That's an opportunity. And we'll see if they're able to seize it. And I don't know if Tatum's going to get there. I do think that he will. I think that this team is good enough, but he's not going to carry them necessarily.
Now, Boston's average age is 25.1. The only team younger than them to win a title, or even in that range, rather, is the Warriors in 14-15, who were 26.4 years old on average. They would be the second youngest team ever to reach the finals. What does that mean for the expectations of this team? Do you think it could potentially be detrimental because of the amount of pressure that would be put on this squad moving forward? Or do you think that's a ridiculous thought?
I don't think that that's really a narrative that's going right now. I honestly don't think that people are talking enough about just how young these guys are, and that's incredibly special. I think that sometimes the youth movement in the NBA is so incredible right now, where we have Devin Booker producing like he is individually, Donovan Mitchell averaging 30-something for a playoff series, Murray and Jokic on one end, on the other end, it's Tatum and Brown and Bam. And sometimes we don't take a step back and realize Jason Tatum is in his third NBA season. He was thrust onto the scene immediately, but he's in his third year. So I don't know if we talk about that enough. I don't think that that's the pressure that's getting to them, the expectation of, wow, look at this incredibly special young team. I think it's more just the pressure of being in these big spots against a team that is going to make it as hard on you as they possibly can to win, and that is not going to let you get out of there ever with an easy W. And that's what the Miami Heat are doing, and they're making these guys work, and they're putting consistent pressure on them both physically and psychologically. So I think that that obviously weighs on a 22-year-old. But I don't think that they're necessarily hyper-aware of the idea that, like, oh, we're the youngest team to do this since the Thunder. I just don't think that they're comparable talent-wise to that team.
For a lot of reasons, the Thunder never got back, the main one being injuries, but it did put a high, high pressure and expectation on that team that ultimately dissolved some of the relationships between a Kevin Durant and a Russell Westbrook, down the line. That definitely had an attributing factor. I don't think it's the reason why that team split up and didn't work, but I definitely think that's in the picture. I did want to ask what you thought this team, the Celtics squad, how does it compare to the Celtics of the 80s with Bird, McHale, Parrish, and when they broke through? How do you think this team kind of compares to that young core that rode this franchise to however many titles?
Well, in some ways it's interesting because if you look at the 81 Celtics, famously, Finals MVP was Cedric Cornbread Maxwell, who wasn't necessarily an old guy. He was only 25 years old, but he was a little more experienced in the league than Larry Bird, who was just in his second season at that time. And Bird had 2 8-point games in those finals. So it's interesting because sort of like right now how a Kemba Walker or a Marcus Smart or a Gordon Hayward can pick up the slack for Tatum, Bird had that with Maxwell, with Dennis Johnson, with these really tremendous players that were a part of that team in that era. So I don't think that it's a difficult comparison to make right now because, again, Bird is a top 10 player of all time. Kevin McHale is really an all-time incredible player. But it's interesting. You see the similar infrastructure in that, yes, there are these two great guys at the root of it. And when they were really young, McHale wasn't necessarily part of that. Obviously, he was a sixth man for much of his career. But Bird was certainly at the center of it. But they also had that infrastructure around them. It was a really well-designed roster. It was a obviously highly prestigious organization. It was run well from the top by Red Auerbach. And they had that identity, and they had those veterans around them who could help them. And then that team blossomed into the point where they became those guys, and they became the most dominant team in the league for a couple years for a reason. So it's interesting. It's tough to speak on really until we see how these guys continue to develop, but they are comparable in that these are two teams with pretty young cores who are – the Celtics haven't done anything historic yet, but if they get to the finals, then they will be there, and obviously it's the same organization. So it's an interesting comparison in that sense.
Fun little aside here. I once shared a flight with Kevin McHale. He was on a flight of mine from Phoenix to Atlanta, and to see such a titan of this sport, one of the iconic faces of a bygone era, crammed into a window seat on a standard jetliner, was certainly funny. I don't. That has nothing to do with this, but just wanted to share. Show and tell time.
I appreciated
it. So, okay, you kind of touched a little bit on it already, but compare the Celtics young duo of Brown and Tatum to that of the Nuggets with Jokic and Murray, who are all in the same age range.
Well, again, I think that we've seen that there's a different level of stardom that these two duos are ascending to. Jalen is being Jalen. He's playing great defense. He's knocking out open shots, and sometimes he's knocking down big shots, and that's fantastic. But Jamal Murray is going out there and getting 50 twice in a series and consistently hitting these unbelievable big shots that you just do not expect a guy who averaged 19 a game in the regular season to do. And that's what fascinates me is Brown and Tatum have been far from bad. They've lived up to expectations, I would say, for the most part. But Murray and Jokic have gone so far beyond expectations. And that's not just dependent on the fact that they came back from 3-1 against the Clippers, but that they came back from 3-1 against the Jazz. It's individual production. Jamal Murray is averaging 27-5-6 on 50-48-91 splits. That is unreal how much he's elevated his level of play. Jokic, we knew that he was capable of it because of last season and because he's the kind of guy who is, you know, a first-team All-NBA level player, but still to see him consistently take over like that, to score 11 straight Nuggets points last night, to not back down against the Anthony Davis-LeBron James Lakers when they were down double digits, and obviously they had that same mentality against the Clippers, and it was Jokic who consistently asserted himself as both a scorer and a passing genius. That's just different from where Tatum and Brown are part of this team that sometimes looks like they're underachieving their talent. They shouldn't have gone to the last minute of a Game 7 against the Raptors. The Raptors were great, but they consistently were eking out close games, whereas the Celtics were beating them relatively comfortably, and it made sense because the Celtics were the more talented team, and that showed, and they barely got out of there alive. They were leading the Heat in both games 1 and 2 by double digits, and they blew both those games, and they got too close in Game 3 in what should have been a blowout considering how well they played for most of that game. So it's just a fascinating contrast between these two guys who aren't getting the same credit for the most part, especially before these playoffs. Obviously, everyone's very aware of the Jokic-Murray narrative now, but who step it up to another level versus the two guys and are launching these incredible comebacks versus the two guys who are sometimes crumbling in the biggest moments. So it's fascinating. I do think that there is, you know, there is a limitation on Jalen Brown's skill set in that he can't be Jamal Murray. He can't wiggle in that mid-range area and make these shots that you just drop your jaw at because he wasn't born with that natural ability.
Mm-hmm.
Tatum has been pretty good for the most part, again, and has had that takeover ability at times. But I still think that if people were looking ahead to these playoffs and were going to say which duo would be more impressive, which duo would go further in the playoffs, it would be the one out east. And maybe they go further in the playoffs, but they certainly have not been more impressive.
I just am personally waiting, and we've seen it hurt this Celtics team against the Raptors. We've seen it really hurt them against the Heat. Last night was a game where Duncan Robinson draws that technical foul from Jaylen Brown, uncharacteristically misses a free throw, but if he hits both of those technical free throws and the Heat come down and hit the three on the following possession, it's a three-point game in a game they had no business being close in the final minute. But just backtracking there, I can't wait for when Jason Tatum, who has had swaths of game action where he has taken over, and he has the skill set to do so, instead of just hitting like one big shot down the stretch, I can't wait for him to take over the last 3 or 4 minutes, say, all right, guys, come with me. We're winning this basketball game. That will be the moment he becomes a top 10 player.
And that's going to be a special moment. And he absolutely has the ability to do that. And I don't want to act like this guy is some schmuck. He's averaging 25, 10, and 5 on a team.
At 22 years old. At 22.
At 22 years old. And that is the pivotal thing to remember for me. He is going to get so much better. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's not some insane skill development because we've seen him add that sidestep three. We've seen him get downhill to the line more, shooting 7 free throws a game in these playoffs. That would have been unthinkable with how much he was settling for mid-range jumpers last year. We've seen him progress. The handles continue to improve. That's fantastic. It's not necessarily there where he's going to get better. We've seen him improve as a defender. That's all solid now. It's that mentality. It's that go-getter attitude that some guys, some of his peers, remarkably already have. Donovan mm-hmm. Mitchell must have just been born with that because he had it as a rookie. And that's insane, where he was willing to go out there and take over games against some of the best players in the world and beat them and outscore them. That's remarkable. Not everyone is born with that. For Tatum, though, it's getting to that point. And it's interesting because people used to say about young KD that he didn't have that gear, that he was fine being second best, that he didn't have that killer mentality. And I think that that's a hilarious notion because it is more innate in some people. That's undeniable. Yeah. Kobe Bryant, Donovan Mitchell, Michael Jordan. Some people are just born.
That list, Kobe Bryant, Donovan Mitchell, and Michael Jordan.
Exactly. Donovan Mitchell is there. No, but you see the similarities in the mentality.
Yeah, of course.
Maybe KD doesn't carry himself like that. Maybe Tatum doesn't carry himself like that. He's not outwardly expressive. And sometimes as a 22-year-old, he's looked a little bit scared at the moment. That's fine. He was also the best player on a team that made the Eastern Conference Finals as a rookie. So that's pretty commendable. But my point is just, KD was a guy who people said that about early in his career. And he's a different level of talent, but he averaged 35 a game in a final series. And he took over and was the best player in back-to-back final series going up against LeBron James. And I don't think that's just because of the outcome of the series. I think that especially if you go back to the 16-17 finals, he was flawless.
Yeah.
And so, and it was in the biggest moments, he just hit these unbelievable dagger shots again and again. And he was 28 when that happened. Guys aren't supposed to be in these spots at 22 years old. So even though I'm the guy who was just talking about how Tatum hasn't lived up to the standard that Jokic and Murray have set out west, that's more about how exceptional those guys are than it is an anti-Tatum thing, because Tatum's still been really good. And he will get that there in his career to where he is the kind of guy who says, come with me, we're winning this game like Kawhi does, like we've seen from so many of the great wings in this game's history, and that is going to be incredible to see. Because he can do that maybe once in a while, but he's not doing it every night, and I just hope he gets there.
Yeah, me too. It'll be great for the sport. Just a couple things here before I ask you one question about the Heat, and we end the night here on Run It Up. So, again, I just am going to pound this point home because I think it's important contextually. I am noting the fact that Michael Jordan played 2 years in North Carolina, multiple years in North Carolina. That changes things timetable-wise. But Michael Jordan didn't make the finals until 29 years old, and we are holding, because the league has gotten younger, some of these young guys to really ridiculous standards. That's a fact. Second thing here, Jason Tatum, in a lot of ways, has performed better on the big stage. He's been to the Eastern Conference Finals now twice in 3 years in the league than Giannis. And that's a fact. That is a fact. He has been in these moments, and whereas Giannis has had his cracks exposed, although Tatum has not been perfect, he has been able to perform consistently at a high level in this scenario way better than Giannis has. And I think that's important to note. I don't want to just rag on a guy who's won back-to-back MVPs and physically dominated the league like we've not ever seen since Shaq. But, yeah, I just think that needs to be put out here. We're wrapping up here. I've got one last question for you. I want to know, we talked before the show. We were figuring out things to talk about. You brought this up. I want to get your thought on it. Has a team like the Heat, and I don't want to do disservice to the team that's winning this series right now 2-1, ever made the finals? Has a team like this, constructed like this, what is the historical precedent for this squad if they are to make it to the big one?
Well, I don't really think that any ever has. And you can obviously look at someone in the no superstar mold. There have been teams like that before. Obviously, people point to the 04 Pistons. But this team is different because it's such a shared team identity, and obviously, it's the fact that they're so dependent on just the shooters who they have all around them. And if you look through the history of the sport, there have been some unbelievable unified teams. You go back to a bunch of the Spurs squads or the Mavs. But there's never been a team where either Jimmy Butler or Bam Adebayo is their best player that also plays like this, where they go 8 deep with guys who are all really important and they just have this sense of pride, the Pistons would be the closest thing, but they were so unbelievable defensively that it's different. The Heat weren't a top 10 defense in this regular season. So I think that that's important to note. It's not like that's some all-time strength that they have. They're playing great defense right now, but they're not that all-time stalwart. So long story short, no, I don't really think so. You can scroll back through all of these decades, and there's never quite been a team like this that is on the that has had the kind of success that the Heat are on the verge of right now.
Of course, there has never been a season like this either. So maybe now is the time. Carson Brebber, thank you for coming on. As always, we'll have you back tomorrow to actually talk about some real basketball because none was played today. You can check him out on the Nerd Sesh podcast. That's available on all streaming platforms. This has been Run It Up, 9:21:20. We got a little bit better today. We'll run it back tomorrow. More college football stuff throughout the week. It's game week, baby.
Go Vols. Bye-bye.